You're listening to All Marine Radio, broadcasting from Costa Mesa, California, on the All Warrior Radio Network. Good morning. I got an email. Mac, you haven't said anything about the recounts. I wonder why. You know, when you think that the people that get elected to political office can't behave any worse, they always impress you with their ability to take it lower. So, anyway, I try not to. The Senate race in Florida got settled. For the Democrats, first woman ever elected in the state of Arizona. And Martha McSally loses. So, what was potentially a 4-seat swing would be what now, a 2-seat swing? Democrats flipped in Nevada and Arizona. They flipped seats there. Republicans gained seats in what, North Dakota, Indiana, Florida. Seat in Mississippi still up for grabs in a runoff that will take place in a week or two. And I think I'm leaving one seat out. So what was thought to be on election night, a larger gain, now not so much. Not so much. So good morning to you. I shake my head, right? This is what leads our country. And this is the game that gets played. So, it is what it is. What saves us from us? Nothing. Nothing saves us. We're doomed. Although, I did have people say that they liked the idea of starting a campaign that says, just turn it off. Hashtag, just turn it off. And sending a message to 24/7 news companies that we would care for Tim Russert and his spirit to be resurrected on a regular basis. Quality. In fact, Bob Woodward is in the news today. Woodward has achieved kind of saintly status among reporters. right? So if you're in that profession, you know Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein. They're Follow the Money, Deep Throat, bringing down the American government of Richard Nixon. Bringing down Richard Nixon's administration, not the American government. So anyway, pulling the curtain back. So anyway, Woodward in the news, and it's kind of interesting because until men like Woodward say what's obvious, and that is the media has got to be better, for God's sakes. But until people like him say that, then I don't know if the media will take anybody else's scrutiny seriously. So if you do a little search, if you haven't seen the article that Bob Woodward is quoted in, if you just do a little search and then you click on the news tab of your search, oddly enough, I'll read you a few headlines. Bob Woodward criticizes CNN's Acosta lawsuit. That's from Fox News. From the New York Post, Woodward blasts CNN's lawsuit over Jim Acosta's credentials. From Newsweek, Bob Woodward, Trump aims to crush and demean people. From, let's see, what other one? The Sioux Falls Argus leader? Probably not. From the Washington Examiner, Bob Woodward, Trump's press strategy is ingenious. We've talked about that kind of stuff. So anyway, Woodward in the news this morning, and I think surprising many people with his comments yesterday. So it's kind of interesting. But again, until guys like Bob Woodward say you all need to be better, nothing will change. Headline, Bob Woodward slams CNN's Acosta lawsuit, says media emotionally unhinged over Trump. Veteran journalist Bob Woodward said Tuesday, that would be yesterday, he was in Naples, Florida, that CNN should get more serious about its reporting instead of suing the Trump administration. The network filed a lawsuit this week after the White House suspended the press credentials of reporter Jim Acosta following a contentious press conference about the midterm election. Does Jim Acosta have, like, a constitutional right to cover the White House? I don't think so. He does so, I believe, at the leisure of the White House. Is he being discriminated against either by race, creed, color? No. They don't like his behavior. Is that not the right of the White House to say we don't want him here based on his behavior? I think it is, honestly. The network filed a lawsuit, blah, blah, blah. Mr. Woodward, the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, worked along Carl Burnside, Quote, in the news media, there has become an emotional reaction to Trump. Too many people for Trump or against Trump have become emotionally unhinged about this. The remedy isn't a lawsuit. It's more serious reporting about what he's doing. So I don't know. Again, sometimes, you know, I say you feel like you're living in bizarro world. And I would tell you that certainly when you watch the intern, you've seen the video, go to take the mic and Acosta kind of move and then put his hand and block her arm. You look at that and you say, if that would have been somebody from Fox News or something like that, there would have been a hue and cry. That person would have been banished not only from the White House, but for I don't know, whatever. Nobody would have said, hey, he was just being, you know, it wasn't really a shove. Nobody would have said anything like that. So again, I think Woodward's point is that the way you see the event is not through your eyeballs, but it's through these lenses you have over your eyeballs, and that is whether you like or dislike whoever's in charge. And that is, in theory, that has not been the charter of American journalism. American journalism, especially American reporting, not journalism, American reporting is supposed, in theory, to report the truth, the facts. That's what reporters do. But, again, the world that we live in is, right? The truth doesn't really matter. The facts may or may not matter. It is getting it out there fastest. It is getting the most overheated headline associated with it and getting clicks. So the financial model has changed. And it's in that competition that this stuff exists. So my compliments to Mr. Woodward for saying what he said. I think more big names in journalism need to come out and be critical of what is happening to their profession, especially the profession of reporting. Okay, talking heads can say whatever they want, but the reporters should stick to reporting, and that happens so much. So anyway, interesting little development this morning. Yesterday afternoon and last night, I was kind of getting ready for today's battlefield study. Today's battlefield study is going to be a little bit of a tour of the Battle of the Little Bighorn. So if you go to the, Mike and I were talking about it a few weeks ago, maybe a week or so ago, and talking about that George Custer did not have a very good day that day. At least that's I've driven the battlefield, right? I was talking about what a cavalry geek I was and what a Custer geek I was as a kid, and I was honestly. I would you want to know why I wanted to become a Boy Scout? You know those yellow scarves they had, reminiscent of cavalrymen. That's why I wanted to be a Boy Scout. I didn't care about anything they did. I wanted to be a cavalryman as a kid. And if you listened yesterday, you heard about I would make guidons. I found a pole, a wooden pole, some kind of 5-foot dowel when I was about 3 feet tall, and I would take it and I would ride my bike and I would have this cavalry guidon. People in my neighborhood must have thought, that kid's weird, man. And we'd go over and play army in the field, man. I'd have this guide on and whatever. So from the time I was young, I was interested. Then I want to say when we moved up to North Dakota, we stopped at the battlefield. And it's not a short, if you look at Gettysburg, it's fairly compact. The battlefield at Bighorn is long. And so it's amazing driving it. But anyway, we're going to look at that. If you go to the read board today, click on read board on the website. You will see battlefield study, Custer and the U.S. 7th Cavalry at Little Bighorn. So if you click on that, it will take you to a couple of maps. Now, the map that's there, you can take your browser and you can magnify it, all right? So if you go to the zoom on your browser, you can the map. I copied the map, and I just put a couple of arrows on it so you can see the general direction of Custer's advance. And then you could also see the where his column went and Major Reno's column went. There's a third column that he sent further south, that Captain Benteen, that later shows back up and blah, blah, blah. But they aren't really instrumental to the battle itself, other than Benteen's refusal to go to Custer's aid. Well done, bruh. If you click on that image, okay, it will take you to the National Parks website. And then that map is zoomable, so you can click again, and then you can scroll through that map, and you can see everything in a little bit more magnified fashion. It's an interesting read in relative to decision-making, which I've always had kind of my decision-making lens that I very, very much enjoy looking at people under pressure and the way they make decisions and can they do it in a timely fashion. And so it got me very, and I kind of embarked on that when I got into LA, light armored reconnaissance and whatnot, because there's a problem when you have a lightly armored vehicle with a gun on it. Because your gun is bigger than a lot of guns out there, you kind of fall in love with it. However, comma, in the world of mobile operations, there's a thing called the tank. Yeah. And one of the worst things that happens to a force is when you fall in love with the gun, you allow somebody to get too close to you and you can't get your ass out of there. And then what happens is a tank shows up and kills everybody. Right? You're shooting a 25mm gun at a tank. It's bouncing off. Ping, 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 ping. Right? And they're shooting 120mm darts through your vehicle that's killing everybody. And it happens very quickly. And you're helpless. And you can't run away, because if you run, you're going to expose yourself. So, yeah, therein lies the danger of falling in love with a gun on a light-armored weapon, be it a light-armored vehicle, be it the LAV that the Marine Corps has in its inventory, or the Bradleys. I mean, they're, bottom line, they're not tanks. So, I started studying it for that reason, cavalry operation. What was the mindset of leaders if you were a cavalryman? And so Custer is really an interesting study, and I don't think you can understand what happens at the Little Bighorn without knowing who he is, where he comes from, and his history as a combat leader in the American Civil War, and out on the plains as well. And as I said yesterday, when I was talking about him, he's one of these guys with a magic bubble. And he fights in every major engagement that the Army of the Potomac fights in. And he's a major general by the end of the Civil War. I want to say he 23 when he graduates from West Point in 1861. So by the age of 27, he's a brevet major general. So he's a temporary major general during the war. And when the war ends, his rank should be captain, but he becomes a lieutenant colonel meritoriously and is sent out to the West, where he fights Indians on the plains, which was the fight of the day. So, George Custer. But the thing he is reckless in the Civil War. There's a thing, and I'll read it to you real quick before we get the show started, but he is a historical combat leader. If you Google a term called Custer's Luck, there's a book entitled Custer's Luck, but that's not what I'm looking for. Custer's Luck was a term that was used by his troops because he never got schwacked. He would do all this crazy shit, and that's why his guys started wearing... He wore a red scarf in the Civil War. Not a yellow one. Yeah. I was confused with my whole Cub Scout thing, right? I didn't really know it was a red scarf. So he wore this red scarf, and his troops started wearing it. Yeah, they called it Custer's luck. Dude doesn't get... Everybody else got smoked. He did not. And so, I mean, it's pretty, but I would tell you, when in doubt, right, he turns to his bugle and says, sound the charge. And they mix it up and, you know, people get killed, but he doesn't. So it starts to understand him, you have to understand the way he commands in the Civil War. And it's a pretty interesting little thing, the way he does it in the Civil War. And so, very charismatic leader, but his style, the way he fights, you could say he was reckless. And but he wins. And so, that's. If you understand that about what comes out of the Civil War, then I think you can understand, you know, the prism that he looks at this through. And we'll talk about that here in a little bit. So, George Armstrong Custer fought at Gettysburg in the cavalry battle against Jeb Stuart that takes place north of town on, what is it, day three or day two? So one of the biggest cavalry battles of the Civil War took place. So Custer's from Michigan, right? I'll just read you a little bit about the cavalry fight. At about 1 o'clock, the massive Confederate artillery barrage in support of the oncoming assault on Cemetery Ridge began. Jenkins' men renewed the attack, but soon ran out of ammunition and fell back. Resupplied, they again pressed the attack. Outnumbered, the Union cavalry fell back, firing as they went. Custer sent most of his 5th Michigan cavalry ahead on foot, forcing Jenkins, who was leading the Confederate cavalry, opposed to him, forcing Jenkins' men to fall back. Jenkins' men were reinforced by about 150 sharpshooters by General Fitzhugh Lee's brigade from Virginia shortly after. Stuart ordered a mounted charge by the 9th Virginia Cavalry and the 13th Virginia Cavalry. Now it was Custer's men who were running out of ammunition. The 5th Michigan was forced back, and the battle was reduced to vicious hand-to-hand combat. Seeing this, Custer mounted a counterattack. Riding ahead of fewer than 400 new troopers of the 7th Michigan Cavalry, shouting, "Come on, you Wolverines." Yeah, he's a Michigan guy. Right, so he leads this charge as this fight's devolving into hand-to-hand combat. As he swept forward, he formed a line of squadrons, okay, because they have squadrons in cavalry, which equal battalions, 5 ranks deep, 5 rows of 80 horsemen side by side chasing the retreating Confederates until their charge was stopped by a wood rail fence. The horses and men became jammed into a solid mass and soon attacked on their left flank by the dismounted 9th and 13th Virginia Cavalry. The pursuing Confederates were cut down by canister, then driven back. So that's Custer, right? So he, you know, and he leads these charges repeatedly. Right. And so, and that's just Gettysburg, and he does it throughout. When in doubt, sound the charge, boys. And you can imagine his troopers, oh shit, here we go again. And he never gets touched. So anyway, we'll look at the Battle of Little Bighorn. Very interesting too. I mean, I was reading last night. I don't know when the last time I read in depth about it. But, so what you're going to hear today, the first thing you'll hear is kind of an overview piece, right? And it comes from of all places, 60 Minutes. 60 Minutes would do things, and they did, I thought, not 60 Minutes, CBS Sunday Morning. And so they take a look at the Battle of the Little Bighorn and do it in a fairly balanced way, pretty balanced way. The next thing you'll hear is from a national park guide, and he narrates the battle. And I think he does it in and I'll stop it where I think he screws it up. But it's well, I would say very good. Then you're going to hear a couple pieces that, one, it's called A Good Day to Die. And you're going to hear, I think, a pretty balanced, with more representation of the Indian perspective. And then the last piece you'll hear is just about 5 minutes, but it's Crazy Horse's account of the Battle of the Little Bighorn. So endeavoring to do kind of a 360 about what happened at Little Bighorn. I think if you understand the way Custer commands, he makes some planning mistakes, and then we're in detail. What I would tell you is, if I was him that day, and I'm not, obviously, but he's a bit arrogant, I think. And if you watch his behavior in the Civil War, he's confident that, you know, when he sounds a charge and they go, good things always happen. Okay. Were it me, I think as a decision maker, if you study decision maker, where people get into big trouble is when they begin to see indicators that contradict their assumptions and they don't pay attention to them. Okay. They don't slow down. They don't take a third look. Okay. They don't take a fourth look. And then by the time they look up, they're in a really bad position. So what happens is Custer changes his plan, and then as he sees indicators that this is not what he thought it was, instead of breaking it off, I mean, because his advantage is he's mobile, and that he doesn't, by the time he realizes it, it's over. The whole thing takes less than an hour. And his command, the 7th Cavalry, was not wiped out. The element that he commanded was. The last person to see him alive is a runner, right, who operates on horse, obviously. I want to say his last name is Martini, who is given a message telling people to come quickly. And then he and everyone in his command, to include two of his brothers and I think a nephew, are killed in what is now called Last Stand Hill. So interesting. If you enjoy military history, if you enjoy decision making, the Battle of the Little Bighorn is one of those. And again, unlike a lot of domestic American fighting, nobody knows for sure, right? I mean, everybody with him was killed. And so you'll hear Native American accounts of it. And so that part is very, very interesting, too. I mean, the Native Americans, they were surprised when they heard the shooting, because their encampment was huge. It was one of the biggest ones that any of the Native Americans involved in it had ever been a part of in their lives. So anyway, so interesting stuff. So do a little historical battle study today. So good morning to you. Thanks for listening to All Marine Radio and making us part of your day. We'll check news headlines coming up. The United States Marine Corps band makes it official. Good morning to you. dedicated to the 7th Cavalry, who rode behind the cavalrymen of the 7th Cavalry. They rode behind George Armstrong Custer, lieutenant colonel type, into the Valley of the Greasy Grass to their death. And if you listen to some of the things that the Native American warriors who fought from a number of tribes said about them, they were the bravest warriors they ever saw. So interesting compliment from Native American warriors. So this is dedicated to their spirit of the 7th Cavalry.
You're betraying your whole life if you don't say what you think, and you don't say it honestly and bluntly.
It defines us. It defines warriors like Gunnery Sergeant John Canley, a leader who led from the front. With his Marines outnumbered, he pushed forward during the Battle of Way City, standing tall during firefights and throwing himself into harm's way to keep his fellow Marines safe.
The only thing I was doing was just responding. The Marines, the young Marines, it shows them that it's not do as I say, it's do as I do. And just being that close with them brings motivation to them.
During firefights, when we'd be all hugging Mother Earth, he'd be standing up directing us. And I think if you talk to every Alpha Company Marine, we're amazed that he was never shot.
For this campus had prepared him well. I'm very confident that, thank you very much. If this was vodka, it'd be a lot better speech. But I'm not supposed to glamorize alcohol anymore, so young folks, you ignore what I just said.
What keeps you awake at night?
Nothing. I keep other people awake at night.
I had a Vietnam vet tell me one time, Jeremiah, you know, PTSD, it's like having a cage in your brain, it's like having a cage full of monkeys. The goal is to keep the monkeys in the cage, because once the bastards make the jailbreak, all hell breaks loose, so you want to keep them in the cage.
Once you're out of the Corps, you know, it's your responsibility to live your life in a way that would honor those that were with you and died. I mean, don't waste your life. Goodness, do something meaningful, and don't be going out there saying, look, oh, woe is me, I'm a poor veteran, or I'm a disabled veteran. Well, yeah, I am a disabled veteran. But, you know, we can't have that kind of attitude. We've got to show people that, hey, we care about our country. We care about what happens to everyone. Marine Corps changed me. It made me a better man, but I don't know a Marine that wouldn't tell you the same thing, Mike.
We just have to execute. And we are executing every day, and Sergeant Major and I are very proud of what you do. Doesn't mean we can't get better. We don't want to make a mistake to learn. We don't want to lose to learn. We cannot lose. if we have to go fight. We got to do what these Marines did here 75 years ago. Persevere against difficult, challenging conditions and odds and win. You got to win.
You know, I love that. I love those quotes. And I listen to them every morning. But the Sergeant Major Canley stuff, do as I do, not as I say. It's called Leadership by Example. I love Jack Riley speaking Alabamese. Well, goodness, Mike. Time for us to check the weather in Marineland. Well, goodness, Mike. I am a disabled veteran, but hell, I love that stuff. Anyway, currently around Marineland, it is mostly cloudy and 42 in Quantico. It is cloudy and 52 at Camp Lejeune. It is raining with some lightning in Granbury, Texas, and 33 degrees. What? Clouds of 49 and 29 Palms. Clouds and 66 at Camp Pendleton. Clear, dark, and 71 in Okinawa. Partly cloudy, 66 in the Al-Anbar province of Iraq. Clear, dark, and 54 in the Helmand province of Afghanistan. Home of All Marine Radio in Costa Mesa, California. Cloudy and 65 degrees. Looking for a high of 82 today. Red flag warning in effects. Winds right now are 2 miles an hour out of the southwest. Humidity at 19%, so it gives you some idea of the dry conditions. Wind's supposed to die down today. And then temperatures cooling the rest of the day. Tomorrow, 77, and on Friday, 72 degrees. That is a look at the weather here in California, where it's making a little bit of news with the fires. It'll be interesting to see what, I was talking to somebody last night about what legislative steps state of California now takes relative to fires. What you're going to see is you're going to see a deep dive on, okay, once we get beyond the global warming and changing the world, right, what do you have to be able to do to protect the community? Yeah, you have to, the environment may have to take a hit. If you're going to put people in those circumstances, there's going to have to be a setback. And it's not going to be a small one either. Okay. And, I want it to come right up to the edge of my property. Sorry, can't have that. So it'll be interesting. So keep your eye on that. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
Hi, this is Tim McGarry from the McGarry Mortgage Minute. Heard every Wednesday right here on All Marine Radio, where I'll answer all your mortgage questions from home buying to home financing, from VA to conventional loans to moving in. So don't miss it. The McGarry Mortgage Minute, right here on All Marine Radio, on the All Warrior Radio Network. And remember, my name is McGarry, and I'm here to help.
Find all of Tim McGarry's contact information on the Read Board page at allmarineradio.com.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nelson. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a group can understand it. Good job, Matt.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com. And I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
A message from DAV to all returning veterans. Thank you. Thank you for doing your duty. Thank you for doing our bidding. Thank you for laying it all on the line. Thank you for stepping up and not backing down. Thank you for putting your future on hold to put our enemies on notice. Thank you for putting your buddies' lives ahead of your own. Thank you for putting yourself in harm's way. Thank you for defending our freedom, for displaying your honor, for being a hero, even though you don't want to be called one. For all this and more, DAV thanks you, and we're here to help you. Expert DAV advisors will make sure you get the health, disability, and financial benefits you were promised and earned. If you're a veteran, visit DAV.org for free help. And again, thank you.
I'm good, but I have a story, and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in a crowd.
I'm good, but the past keeps coming back.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good.
Are you really listening?
I'm good, but I can't get out of bed.
I'm good, but I can't sleep.
I'm good, but I feel overwhelmed.
I'm good, but I don't feel safe.
I'm good, but I still have nightmares.
I'm good, but I don't need any help.
I'm good, but I don't feel anything anymore.
I'm good, but I can't live like this anymore.
I'm really not so good. Are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1 for free 24/7 confidential support.
Hi, I'm Colleen McNamara. And you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warriors Radio Network.
I want to walk you to a cold, bitter ocean, feel the sting of...
Okay, I'll tell you the part I like. I like the whole spot. I like harmonies.
I want to drive fast till I break down in nowhere, so I should finally
coming up.
Cry these tears when I reach there. I scream.
Here it is.
Yeah, let it all out.
There's just scenes where I let it all out. You hear the harmony in the background.
Right now it's just me.
I think that's her sister, she said.
So I'm gonna stand here and watch this cigarette burn. It hurts.
You can find it on iTunes and I believe Google Music. I should look that up. I should know that. Peyton Davis. All right, news headlines. There's a bunch of news. You want to know why? Because all the reporters had a three-day weekend. All right, so, yeah, and now they all got back to work and started filing stories. Headline, here's how the Corps is trying to better inform the FBI of Marines prohibited from purchasing firearms. So you'll remember a year ago when that Air Force dude went into that church and shot it up and killed, 20-something people? He had been placed on by virtue of the characterization of his discharge, he should not have been able to buy firearms. Turns out, the people that are supposed to tend to that list, make sure that data point gets to the FBI so they can disseminate it, were not doing their job. Anyway, and they went, I want to say they published lists by branch of service, who was good and who was bad, and nobody was very good at reporting that kind of information. The Marine Corps has pushed out guidance across the force to help ensure the FBI and law enforcement agencies are properly informed about Marines who may no longer legally be allowed to acquire firearms or ammunition due to legal troubles during their service. The effort by the Corps is intended to streamline how it informs the FBI and law enforcement agencies about Marines who could pose a risk to society following a deadly November 2017 shooting in Texas by an Air Force veteran who killed more than 24 people. According to the Monday MAR admin, commanders are responsible for reporting all criminal justice information to the FBI, especially Marines whose legal troubles during their time in the Corps may prohibit them from transferring or purchasing firearms and ammunition. Commanders, lieutenant colonels, and above are to report to the servicing LEA, law enforcement agency, within 5 working days when a service member triggers a prohibition on receipt or possession of firearms or ammunition under the reference. Triggering actions include non-judicial punishment for drug use, administrative separation board results substantiating unlawful drug use, adjudications at special court-martials or general court-martials. So anyway, little fallout from a year ago that I'm sure the Marine Corps was working on, and then highlighted by the events of in Thousand Oaks. After 17 years, this is an Associated Press story that appears in Military Times, many Afghans blame the U.S. for the unending war. Well, who else are they going to blame? When U.S. forces and their Afghan allies rode into Kabul in November 2001, they were greeted as liberators. But after 17 years of war, the Taliban have retaken half the country. Security is worse than it's ever been, and many Afghans place the blame squarely on the Americans. The United States lost more than 2,400 soldiers in its longest war and has spent more than $900 billion on everything from military operations to construction of roads, bridges, and power plants. 3 U.S. presidents have pledged to bring peace to Afghanistan, either by adding or withdrawing troops, by engaging the Taliban or shutting them. Last year, the U.S. dropped the mother of all bombs on a cave complex. None of it has worked. After years of frustration, Afghanistan is rife with conspiracy theories, including the idea that Americans didn't stumble into a forever war but planned it all along. Mohammed Ismail Qasimar, a member of Afghan's High Peace Council, wonders how U.S. and NATO forces, which at their peak numbered 150,000 and fought alongside hundreds of thousands of Afghan troops, were unable to vanquish tens of thousands of Taliban. Either they did not want to or they could not, he said. He now suspects the U.S. and its ally Pakistan deliberately sowed chaos in Afghanistan to justify the lingering presence of foreign forces, now numbering around 15,000, in order to use the country as a listening post to monitor Iran, Russia, and China. They have made a hell, not a paradise for us, he said. So, interesting little story. There's elements of truth to that. The United States does need, for strategic reasons, we need a presence in the region. It helps. No doubt about that. But that is not the reason that things have gone the way they have gone there. U.S. officials believe former Marine captain held hostage in Syria for 6 years is still alive. It says officials. I don't know who these officials are. Officials announced Tuesday that they believe that Marine veteran turned journalist Austin Tice is still alive and is being held hostage in Syria 6 years after his capture. Robert O'Brien, the special presidential envoy for hostage affairs, told reporters at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday that the U.S. government believes Tice is alive. Well, let me tell you, that's pretty official. Right? The U.S. envoy relative to hostage affairs at the National Press Club in Washington, I'm not sure you get more official than that stuff. Quote, as many of you know, Austin's case is a tough one. He's been missing. He's been held captive since August of 2012. It's now long past the time for his captors to allow Austin to come home. Top officials have been meeting with the Tice family over recent months to keep them appraised of efforts to bring him home. Mark Tice, Austin's father, told the crowd that the consensus is that his son is alive. He thanked media members and government officials for keeping his son's story in the spotlight. Austin, 37, is a former Marine Corps infantry captain who fought in Iraq and Afghanistan and was attending Georgetown University and freelance reporting for various media outlets at the time of his capture. Pariah states like Iran, terrorist groups around the world, continue to take people hostage or unjustly detain them, O'Brien said. When asked by journalists if he could identify the group that was holding Tice and whether there had been any, quote, proof of life evidence received shortly after Tice's disappearance, O'Brien said he could not answer those questions. O'Brien later confirmed the government officials believe that Tice is being held captive in Syria, but declined to share any further details, citing Tice's safety and security. Interesting. Kidnapping in the Middle East is a profession, for God's sakes. Kidnap important people and then you ransom them. Yeah, that's what they do. This tribe steals cars, transports them all over the Middle East. This tribe, they're kidnapped. What? That's what they do. Yeah, they keep somebody and they hold them for as long as they need to hold them until the family pays their ransom. Wow, who knew? I thought only the mafia did that. This classified operation supports the Saudi military campaign in Yemen. One of three new classified operations initiated by the Pentagon earlier this year was launched to support Saudi Arabia and other partner nations operating in Yemen, recent reports and documents have revealed. As the Yemen war, raging for more than 3 years, has reached historic levels of humanitarian crisis, including mass starvation, civilian deaths, and cholera outbreaks, U.S. arms sales and support with intelligence and logistics for the Saudi military operations has come under increased scrutiny. Operation Yukon Journey was named in a recent quarterly report by the Department of Defense IG's office, but the initial note, only a few paragraphs in a 130-page document, referred to three named operations that were classified, two in Africa, one in the Middle East. All three operations are in support of larger efforts which seek to defeat ISIS and Al-Qaeda. Kind of squishy. looking at footnotes that refer to classified operations and writing stories about them. Okay. All right. Next headline. Here's a sexy one for you. The sniper shortfall. Why the Corps could lose its next urban fight. Where's Chicken Little? Cue Chicken Little. A legendary Marine Corps sniper who earned the Silver Star during the First Battle of Fallujah has a warning for the Corps. Snipers are integral to urban combat, and the Marine Corps needs to adequately address its shortage of deadly marksmen. Ethan Pace was a corporal in April 2004 when he found himself perched as a sniper on a rooftop in Fallujah, staring through the scope of his M40A3 rifle, scanning the long urban alleys of the Iraqi city, looking for insurgents seeking to harm his fellow Marines, clearing the city below. Urban terrain for snipers is a dream world for shooting positions and angles, the ability to hide and move, Pace told Marine Corps Times in an interview. Quote, we were able to push the enemy completely back and also limit their range and their movement as well. They didn't understand how far we could shoot. While insurgents were kept at bay with precision shots, Marine snipers had freedom of movement on Fallujah's rooftops, knocking out loopholes or moving through connected houses and blown holes in walls of the tightly connected old city. For snipers and their spotters, it was very easy to move back and forth, Place said. We'd shoot from one, hide, and move to another. He would leave Iraq with 32 confirmed kills as a scout sniper with 2nd Battalion 1st Marines. The lessons from the Corps' fight in Fallujah have not been lost. In 2017, only 42 students attended the sniper course, and as of June 2018, only 77 Marines have attended. The numbers are below the nearly 100 Marines averaged in previous years, going back to 2013. The Marine Corps Times does not have the final 2018 attendance numbers as of yet. And the 14 sniper graduates as of 2018 is on track to be the lowest numbers of snipers to successfully navigate the rigorous course since 22 graduated in 2017. Only 29 made it through in 2014. The Corps typically has 300 scout snipers. Kaylin Wojcik, a former Marine sniper who left the Marine Corps in 2005, told the Marine Corps Times. But the Corps says it only has 150 sergeants and below holding the coveted 0317 scout sniper job field. Quote, the advanced decision-making, infantry, and marksmanship skills necessary to attain this qualification make the Marine Scout Sniper Course one of the most challenging schools in the Marine Corps, Captain Caroline Foote, a Marine spokesman, told Marine Corps Times. However, the Corps argues that it has sufficient inventory of scout snipers to consistently meet its operational requirements and accomplish its mission, footnoted. The article takes issue with that. Top five stories in early bird. Number one, T-38 crashes in at Laughlin. That's not Laughlin, Nevada, but Laughlin Air Force Base in Texas. Judging by the headline, I would have been wrong to say what I was going to say. One pilot died in a T-38 training aircraft Tuesday night at Laughlin Air Force Base in Texas. In a post on its Facebook page, Laughlin said that the other pilot has been transferred to Valverde Regional Medical Center. The name of the pilots has not been released. Laughlin said, a board of officers will convene, blah, 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 blah. Another T-38C Talon, which is the Air Force training aircraft, crashed in November of 2017, resulted in the death of its two pilots. Story number two, U.S. Air Force moves to fortify F-35 weak points against hacking. Remember the GPS hack in the NATO exercise? That's Russia leaving its calling card, right? We're watching. We can jack your shit up if we want to. The U.S. Air Force is devoting fresh energy to plugging cybersecurity holes in the F-35's external support systems, as they are deemed the easiest entry points for hackers into the fifth-generation combat jet, according to a key service official. It's a software-based aircraft, and any software-based platform is going to be susceptible to hacking, Brigadier General Stephen Jost, director of the Air Force F-35 Integration Office, told Defense News in an interview at the International Flight Industry Conference. The service considers the information backbone to be the actual airplane managed by Lockheed Martin to be relatively safe. This is thanks to what Joe's calls multi-layer security protections, ranging from secure authentication when crafting mission data package for each aircraft before takeoff to pilots punching in personal identification numbers to start the aircraft. The confidence wanes as you get further from the air vehicle, Joe says, when taking into account systems like Autonomic Defense Logistic Information System or the Joint Reprogramming Environment, there are a lot of nodes of vulnerability that we're trying to shore up. Weak points further down the line. Another story. Number three, more than a dozen U.S. Navy SEALs may get caught up in a war crimes investigation. Military officials are prepared to call nearly a dozen past and present Navy SEALs to testify in the case of one elite Navy commando accused of fatally stabbing an Islamic State detainee in Iraq last year, according to documents obtained by Navy Times. The records related to the NCIS investigations offer new insight into the probe that will be aired publicly when the case against Special Warfare Chief Edward Eddie Gallagher goes to an Article 32 hearing today in San Diego. The document suggests the military officials have obtained cell phone text conversations showing Gallagher allegedly sought to cover up the fatal stabbing. The records also show that a different special operator may be acting like a mole for federal investigators by attempting to talk to another petty officer who was lawyered up and invoked his right to silence. Military prosecutors have also accused one of Gallagher's commissioned officers, Lieutenant Jake Portier, of allegedly covering up the war crime, but authorities have not scheduled an Article 32 hearing for him. The trove of documents given to Navy Times shows that at least 9 active duty SEALs at Coronado Base, Naval Special Warfare Group 1, and one of their fellow commandos who recently left the service have given sworn statements and provided videotaped interviews about Gallagher 39 to NCIS. Next story. A crisis of national security. New report to Congress sounds the alarm. America's military superiority has eroded to a dangerous degree, leaving the U.S. in a crisis of national security, especially if faced with more than one conflict at once, a new congressionally mandated report concluded. The U.S. military could suffer unacceptably high casualties and loss of major capital assets in the next conflict, reads a report issued Wednesday by the National Defense Strategy Commission. Quote, it might struggle to win or perhaps lose a war with China or Russia. The United States is particularly at risk of being overwhelmed should its military be forced to fight on two or more fronts simultaneously. Additionally, it would be unwise and irresponsible not to expect adversaries to attempt debilitating kinetic, cyber, and other attacks against Americans at home while they seek to defeat our military abroad, the authors reported. Quote, the U.S. military superiority is no longer assured, and the implications for Americans' interest and American security are severe. The commission is congressionally empowered. It's a bipartisan committee put together in July of 2017. Three individuals were assigned by the House and Senate Armed Service Committee leadership. The late John McCain, ranking Democratic member Jack Reed, and House Armed Service Committee Chairman Mac Thornberry, Republican from Texas, and ranking member Adam Smith, Democrat of Washington. While the report is warning of potential doom for the United States military, are not unknown in Washington, the nature of this report, a requirement from Congress with handpicked experts, means that it will inevitably get attention on the Hill, just as a new Congress with Democrats now running the House settles on a fiscal year 20 budget fight. The group was chaired by Eric Edelman, a former U.S. ambassador and Undersecretary of Defense for Policy from 2005 to 2009, and Gary Roughhead, a retired admiral who was the 29th Chief of Naval Operations from 2007 to 2011. In a strange twist, one of the members of the panel was John Kyle, at that point a former senator and now the man who is filling John McCain's seat. So, interesting reading there in a relatively new report that will come to Congress, sounding a crisis of national security. Question is, will anybody pay attention to it? You know, a number of years ago, we decided that we would no longer configure the Department of Defense to fight two wars simultaneously, right? So once that gets changed, we can save more money. Because we're only going to really fight at one adversary at a time. Maybe not. One more story in early bird. Are those Florida ballots that Trump says showed up, quote, out of nowhere, unquote, from military absentee voters? In Florida in particular, if a ballot coming from overseas was registered from a registered voter, it's postmarked by Election Day, November 6th. It will be counted even if it arrives by November 16th. Over the years, many states have enacted legislation that extends deadlines for those voters to make sure the ballots get there to be counted. Quote, as far as I'm concerned, this, in parentheses, Florida election isn't over till November 16th. That's legal, and any ballot from a military voter or citizen overseas that's postmarked by the 6th and arrives by the 16th has the right to be counted, should be included in a certified ballot count. Blah, 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 blah. Florida, man. God, would it just go away? Also, after an election loss, Air Force veteran Representative Martha McSally could still end up in the Senate. How, you might ask. Martha McSally lost the seat for retiring United States Senator Jeff Flake. Senator-elect Kristen Sinema will be Arizona's first female senator. She's a Democrat. Almost immediately after her concession speech, speculation began about whether McSally could end up in Arizona's other Senate seat. Earlier this year, following the death of Senator John McCain, Governor Doug Ducey appointed John Kyle, K-Y-L, I don't know if you pronounce it Kyle or Kyle, I'll say Kyle. Sounds better than kill. John Kyle to serve in his post until at least the end of 2018. Kyle has indicated he does not want to serve beyond that point. So, might Martha McSally be in the Senate anyway? Neither McSally nor Ducey has made any public statement on the possible appointment. Arizona media began debating this subject Tuesday morning following McSally's concession speech Monday night. So you have a chance to see that. A couple more headlines that I just wanted to mention before we go to the state of Montana and check out the Battle of Little Bighorn. China, as yet unveiled stealth bomber, could alter U.S. defense calculus in the Pacific. You want to know what the next thing that's going to happen is? Radar is going to get tweaked, and so there will be no stealth. Investments will be made in radar so that the stealth thing goes away. And again, it's just Alex Hollings and I were talking about. You know, you hear these like, oh, this tank or this missile or this, that, and the other thing, and then all of a sudden somebody defeats it with some other piece of technology. What is that thing's vulnerability? How is it guided? What does it need to be directed? Well, we'll attack that. Right. So anyway, interesting. It's a spiral of technology and weapons, right? You see it in the Civil War, right? The formations of the Civil War are a thing of Napoleonic tactics devised when mass infantry formations shot at each other with smooth bore muskets. The accuracy of those smooth bore muskets was not very much. So you could be concentrated and you could march up and you shot at each other, and that's how people fought. With the advent of rifling, right, in the barrel of a musket and the mini ball, you now can reach out and touch somebody at 700 meters. And so you see the casualty figures become what they become in the American Civil War until a guy by the name of Emory Upton says, hey, why don't we spread out? Why don't we spread out and we'll move spread out? And all of a sudden the casualty rates go down and they win. Like, oh, he may be onto something. And so the rifle, the deadly rifle fire, now is greatly reduced simply by a tactical innovation by somebody who was using their coconut. So you see it all the time. And this will be no different. All right. We will take a break. A great example of, it was the TOW-2 Bravo. You know, the front armor on tanks got so substantial that you could no longer penetrate it with an anti-tank weapon that was portable, right? It was the only thing that could kill it was another tank. And even a shape charge, right, with the advent of what was called appliqué armor, which is armor that is attached to the outside of the ship, of the tank, and it essentially explodes when it gets hit. Well, what that does is it detonates, or it functions, the anti-tank weapon, which was a shape charge designed to bore into the tank in a relatively small aperture. It explodes on the applique armor, and then it spends itself on the exterior of the tank, as opposed to exploding on the armor and going through it. So what happened? The TOW-2 Bravo is invented, and it's designed to fly over the top of the tank in what was the least armored section of the tank, and then fire down into the tank. And so that is the spiral, like all those little military dorks that you see with slide rules and pocket protectors and things like that, the little gnomes of death, that's what they do. They figure shit like that out. Yeah, You know, they wear the horn-rimmed glasses, the pocket protector, the slide rule, belt buckle, all that. Those dudes. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to go to the Battle of Little Bighorn. So we're going to go from general to specific, and you're going to hear a number of different clips. Try to give us a 360-degree view of what happened in the summer of 1876 as three different columns set out from three different forts in the upper plains to attempt to get, quote, hostile Native Americans from a variety of different tribes back on their reservations as our federal government attempted to solve the Native American problem as America moved west under the idea of manifest destiny. It was our nation as European settlers to conquer from sea to shining sea. So you'll see the a military aspect of it and a great victory for a confederation of Native American tribes that ultimately, a great tactical victory that ultimately becomes a resounding strategic defeat. Galvanizes the United States federal government into sending more troops and hunting down those responsible for it, returning them to reservations and whatnot. So we'll get into that coming up next on a Wednesday edition of All Marine Radio, Battlefield Study Day, coming up next.